This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hey, it's Jen. A quick heads up before we start the show. Today, we're talking about pregnancy and some of the complications associated with it. This conversation will include talk of miscarriage and stillbirth, which may be hard to listen to, and we understand. You can find a different conversation at the1a.org. And thanks for listening. Pregnancy is hard, and that's before you consider that as many as half of pregnancies come with added complications. Economist Emily Oster became a big name in pregnancy advice 10 years ago with her book, Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. As an economist, Oster uses data to help people better understand the different scenarios they might face in pregnancy, including when things don't go smoothly. Her latest book is called The Unexpected, Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications. She co-wrote it with maternal fetal medicine doctor Nathan Fox, and it's out this week. Today, we talk about some of those complications and how patients can get better care from their doctors. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We've got a lot to get into, so stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy.
Joining us from New York is Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University and the author of the Parent Data book series and newsletter. Emily, it's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Chicago is Dr. Janelle Bolden. She's an OBGYN and the chief of maternal fetal medicine at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. Dr. Bolden, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
And a quick note, our experts are not a replacement for seeing your own doctor and cannot give personal medical advice, so make sure that you consult with your provider. Emily, how does this book differ from the others you've written?
So this book is... My other books were largely inspired by my own journey, and this book is really inspired by the journey of my readers. Since Expecting Better came out, I've talked to thousands of women about their experiences, and some of those experiences were very hard. And our goal with this book is to answer many of those questions I've gotten from people. Will this complication happen again? What kind of treatment options are there? And how can I navigate those conversations with my doctor?
As a maternal fetal medicine doctor, Bolden, a big part of your job is to help patients through higher risk pregnancies. What complications do you see most often?
As a maternal fetal medicine physician, I see multiple complications, including things like diabetes, preeclampsia, and unfortunately, since it's so common, I see issues with recurrent miscarriage or even stillbirth in the later gestation.
And in a maternal fetal medicine doctor in that practice, what are you focused on?
So I take a very strong interest in maternal medical complications, either issues that patients come into the pregnancy with or if they acquire some type of complication during the pregnancy. I also have a great interest in multiple gestations as well, so twins, triplets, things like that.
Emily, you said you heard from a lot of your readers about their experiences during pregnancy. How did you narrow down which complications to focus on in this book?
So the book is structured in two parts. We begin with a general guide, and our hope is that that will help people struggling with any complication, even if it's not one of the ones we talk about more specifically. In the second half of the book, we have chapters about many of the most common complications: miscarriage, stillbirth, but also gestational diabetes, hyperemesis. We try to be fairly comprehensive. We actually came up with this initial set of topics through talking to people and through doing surveys. So at some point, I put out a call for people to talk about their complications. We got almost 4,000 responses from parents, many of which were very, very long. And we used that to try to think about which were the complications and questions that were coming up most frequently.
And where do you gather your data from?
So the book relies on medical literature to look at questions like, what is the risk of recurrence? What kind of treatment options are available? So that involves going into the data, going into the published literature, meta-analyses, randomized trials, observational data, when that's what's available. It's really intended to be a comprehensive look at what we know in the literature. The book also, and this is really the role of my amazing co-author, Dr. Fox, talks through how to have conversations with your provider with the guidance of that data that we start with. So we start with, what does the evidence say? How do we understand this complication? And then how can you talk to your doctor about what might be right for you in your specific situation?
What are the limitations to taking this data-driven approach, Emily? Because there's what the data says, and then there's the experience you're having.
Yeah, so I see data as and one important input to decision-making. And really, in this and almost any other space, what we are interested in is making the right decision for our family, for our pregnancy. And understanding the data is going to be an input there, but it's only one input. And in many of the complications we talk about in this book, there is an important role for patient preferences, for medical knowledge of their specific case, which may not be captured in aggregate data. So we want to be taking the data and using it in a way that is effective, but understanding that our ultimate goal is to make a decision about pregnancy or about whatever is the choice we have, and making that decision in as informed a way as possible.
We're talking to economist Emily Oster. She's the author of the Parent Data Book Series, a newsletter. Also with us, Dr. Janelle Bolden. She's the chief of maternal fetal medicine at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. And we'd be honored to hear your pregnancy stories, too. Did you have a complication you had to navigate? How did it go? And what questions do you still have about your experience? Email us at 1a@wamu.org. Dr. Bolden, this book and Expecting Better aim to help patients with shared decision making between them and their providers. How have these books and the more informed nature of patients these days, because we can Google anything, how has it changed how you're working with your patients?
I think it has certainly changed the way that patients and providers have historically had a relationship. If you think about decades and decades ago, it was much more of a paternalistic approach. The doctor said something, and then the patient pretty much listened. These days, I think it is a much better and a much more informed patient where they have information. They have books like this. They have Google, just like you said. And it allows us to have a better conversation with patients and then hopefully be able to come to that shared decision-making, one that involves data, but again, also really focuses on what the patient wants and their desires moving forward for a successful pregnancy.
Emily, how has taking a data-driven approach helped you make decisions during your pregnancies?
So I am a person who loves data, and my experience in my first pregnancy is largely what inspired the whole book series, and I wanted to take a more data-oriented approach than I think was common at the time. We were really talking about my daughter's 13, so a large number of years ago. And I have found the data to be a very helpful frame for a lot of decision-making, although I completely agree with what Dr. Bolden says. It is one piece of that. And thinking about how we balance that with all of the other considerations is how we get to the right set of choices for ourselves.
While pregnancy complications can happen to anyone, the risk varies greatly by race. Emily, what does your research show about how race and racism plays into complications?
We see a lot of evidence across almost all of the complications we talk about in this book that suggests that, Black women in particular are at higher risk for complications. And understanding exactly why that is, it's a multifaceted issue. It has to do with lack of access to resources. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that some forms of structural racism in general are driving some of these disparities. But whatever is the reason, I think the key is to be focused on how we can improve those disparities and how we can improve maternal health, both broadly but specifically for Black women who are most heavily affected.
Dr. Bolden, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well.
I completely agree with Emily's point here. We do know that patients who are Black have a much higher risk of pretty much any pregnancy complication you can think of. And like Emily mentions in the book and said just now, it's not really about the race. It's about the way that Black women have to navigate life in general and the racism that involves this. There's a lot of work and research going on right now to break these barriers down and to really do our best to gain equity among all pregnant patients as far as complications go. So there's a lot more work to be done and a lot of work that's happening right now to do this.
We're going to dig into some of the specific complications you write about in the book. But Emily, if someone is experiencing a pregnancy right now, maybe a complicated pregnancy, what would you say to them about how to use this book?
The ideal way to use this book is to read the first part first, which gives you a very general sense of how to, what kind of information might be useful, how to structure conversations with your provider. And then we anticipate people will read the parts of the second half of the book that are relevant for them. It's really intended as a guide for people struggling with these complications, and that's how we hope people will use it.
Let's head to a quick break here. When we return, we discuss ways to think about a second pregnancy when the first was complicated. More from you and our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message we got from Caitlin, who says, I'm a high-risk pregnancy due to non-pregnancy-related issues. I just got my blood work and talked with my provider. I have gestational diabetes. I want to be well-informed on the impacts for the rest of my pregnancy and labor. Where do I find the best research for impacts and necessary interventions? I'd like to hear from both of you on this. Emily, I'll come to you first.
So we write about gestational diabetes in the book, and I think the good news there is that if well managed, gestational diabetes is among the can be among the less serious of the complications we talk about, assuming you have good management and we have good approaches there. But I'd love to hear from Dr. Bowden about how she would respond here.
Yes, I agree. I think that gestational diabetes is common. That's why we screen for it, because we know that there is an effective treatment. I know it sounds scary initially to think about changing your diet and maybe getting a new exercise plan and maybe needing insulin, but these are all things that we can talk through whenever that diagnosis is made. And we can also take a multidisciplinary approach using nutritionists and endocrinologists and dietary educators to be able to come up with a plan specifically for the patient. I also think that there's plenty of information online. Our bodies, including ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, SMFM, have a lot of good patient information and patient-friendly documents online that can help you through this as well.
Well, Emily, since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago, 21 states have imposed restrictions on abortions, but there is an overlap between abortion and miscarriage care that the laws and restrictions don't always account for. How are abortion bans affecting care for pregnancy complications?
In general, when people encounter pregnancy complications, there are a lot of complicated medical decisions that have to be made, some of which are literally life and death for both mom and baby. And in those moments, taking away the opportunity for doctors and patients to make the choice that is appropriate for that moment, that is going to make those interactions worse. It's going to make the risks higher. It's going to potentially cause long-term harm or even death. So I think when we think about removing choice, and we think about introducing these draconian restrictions on abortion care, we are affecting many people who maybe we didn't intend to affect, and causing real extreme damage.
Dr. Bolden, you're in Illinois, and that state does not have abortion restrictions in place until after fetal viability, around 24 weeks. What's your advice for people facing pregnancy complications who are in states with restrictions?
I think that's an excellent question. I'm so grateful to be able to practice in a state that has a lot more freedom about these particular issues. I would advise any patient who is becoming pregnant or who is already pregnant, number one, to know what their state's restrictions are, because that way you'll be best informed in case you need to go to a different state or think about different options for your pregnancy. So I think just being informed is the best way to move forward there.
I want to note that we've had many conversations in the last 2 years on abortion restrictions and how they are affecting miscarriage care. You can find those at the 1A.org. We were talking about racial bias in medicine. And we got this message from Aaron, who emails, "I've heard a lot that as a Black woman, I'm at a much higher risk for pregnancy complications and that we as a society need to do better. But what can I, as the Black woman, do?" Dr. Bolden, what advice do you give your patients?
I'm going to sound like a broken record a little bit here, but I think, number one, be informed and do not be afraid to ask questions. I think that is one of the best ways to advocate for yourself is to do your best to know what is going on. And if someone doesn't feel comfortable asking questions or talking to their provider, bring someone with you. Bring a partner, a friend, someone who also feels comfortable enough that they can ask these hard questions and open that dialogue between the patient and the provider.
We got this email from Alex who says, "I had 4 miscarriages before getting pregnant with my daughter. Of course, my pregnancy was very stressful. In the last month, I had put on 36 pounds. I had swelling all over my body. My blood pressure was around 140 over 80, and I was seeing black butterflies. I kept saying that something was wrong, but they didn't listen. They said I will have a big baby over 9 pounds, even with the sonogram 4 days before the delivery. My daughter weighed less than 6 pounds at birth 4 days later. I felt totally unheard and left alone." Emily, part of the book focuses on helping patients and doctors have better conversations about possible complications. When you hear a story like that, what are your big takeaways?
It makes me sad, and I hear it too often, that people feel that they are not being heard. And in some ways, this is where I would echo Dr. Bolden's advice of bringing someone with you, that sometimes having someone else on the outside to help advocate can be very effective. In some ways, I wish that weren't true, but meet people where they are, and sometimes having another person to help be that advocate can be really effective.
And Dr. Bolden, for people on the other side of that equation, the medical providers, What guidance do you give them about how to better listen to what their patients are saying and understanding what that patient may need from them?
I think that's a great question. I do agree with Emily that that email makes me sad. It's so unfortunate where the interactions between provider and patient just don't go the way that they should or could have been improved. I think the easiest way is for providers to treat each patient that they see on their schedule just as they are, as a human being having an experience where they need to go in without judgment, without bias as much as possible, and sit down and listen to the patient. I know it seems really easy. Sometimes it can be very difficult on the provider side to kind of get rid of all that background noise and just focus on the patient in front of them. But I think that's the best advice. Take each individual patient encounter just as it is, a human having an experience, and they need our help.
Well, there are two ways to give birth these days, vaginally or via a cesarean or C-section. And Emily, much of your book is written for people who've had a pregnancy and are now thinking about another. For people who had a C-section the first time, they often have the option of scheduling another C-section or trying for a vaginal birth after cesarean, referred to as a VBAC. Stacy called us from Houston to share her VBAC story.
I tried to have a VBAC after I'd had twins 18 months earlier, and I tried to have VBAC for my daughter. When that happened, they let me labor too long before they decided that they needed to go ahead and do the cesarean. And the doctor was in such a rush that he ended up clipping my ureter, which caused me to get very, very sick. I had to have a right ureter resection, and spent very many, many months being sick. I no longer have a functioning right kidney and have had bladder and kidney infections since. So I would just say be very careful about doing a VBAC and make sure that you go over it with your doctor many times and really understand what could happen.
So, Emily, you dove deep into the decision to have another C-section or a VBAC for a subsequent birth. What does the data say people should be thinking about when making that choice?
So the trade-off between a VBAC or trying for a VBAC and a repeat cesarean is really between the small risk of something, of a serious complication of a trial of labor. A uterine rupture would be the most common of the rare complications that could happen. So that's the risk of the C-section. That's the risk of trying for a vaginal birth. The risk of a repeated C-section is that, in general, the recovery from a C-section is longer. And, you know, for many women, they would like to try for a vaginal birth, particularly if they're hoping for even more children later. So this is an example in the book, probably the starkest example, where having a conversation where you really understand the risks on either side, the risk on either side for you in particular, and the preferences of the patient, those things really need to combine. For some people, the prospect of a VBAC is really important, and for others, it's not. And so it's difficult for one person in the conversation to make this choice. It really is about both the medical expertise, the medical understanding of the risk for that patient, and what the patient ultimately wants.
We're going to head to a quick break here, and we'll be back with more of the conversation in just a moment. Still to come, the fourth trimester. Pregnancy complications don't always resolve with birth. What serious complications should we be aware of in the postpartum period? That's just ahead.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Let's get back to the discussion with this message we got from one of you.
My son was born vaginally with his hand on his face, so he scratched up my insides on the way out, and I was stitched up and told everything would be fine. But a couple days later, the stitch popped loose, and it happened to have been on an artery, and I was bleeding so much the blood actually formed a clot, which put pressure on the artery and slowed the bleeding down. But we rushed to the ER, and I like gave birth again to a four pound blood clot. Just, I guess, wanted to share my story. I don't really have a question, but it was terrible, and I'm scared to have a second kid.
Thanks for that message. Emily, we heard in that voicemail someone saying, I'm scared to have a second kid because it's unpredictable. How often do you hear that from your readers, that the first experience was traumatic in some way, and now considering a second child, it's giving them pause?
A lot. I hear that a lot. And I think there's two pieces of it. One is literally being afraid this will happen again. But even in a case like that that listener described, where it's unlikely that particular complication will happen again, to move forward with a pregnancy knowing that something low probability but really terrible could happen, that's hard. And I think it's hard to get around the idea of you might need to move forward even knowing that these things could happen. And Nate talks in the book about the idea of radical acceptance, of being able to live with the fact that something bad happened and yet think about trying to move forward again. Sometimes that's necessary, even though that's really, really hard.
Dr. Bolden, we talk about complications during pregnancy, but what are the complications people should be aware of during recovery from pregnancy and childbirth?
I think there are certain complications, right, that do occur after delivery. Preeclampsia is something that can happen after delivery. Blood clots can happen after delivery. I think probably much more common would be postpartum mood disorders. So postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety are all complications that perhaps aren't talked about as much, but can be very significant and really have an impact on recovery after delivery and caring for the infant as well.
Well, that brings us to Colette, who called from Virginia to share their story.
Hi, it's Colette from Richmond, Virginia. And I had what to expect when you're expecting, figuring that's kind of all I would need. But I didn't anticipate having postpartum depression and a baby that had colic. I ended up joining a group of other moms that also had postpartum depression, and that saved me. So I wish I had known more at the beginning.
Colette, thanks for sharing your story. Emily, what should we know when it comes to postpartum mental health?
15 to 20% of women will experience postpartum depression, and a good share of that actually starts during pregnancy. So this is much more common than people think. And the positive news is that we have a lot of treatments that can help, both non-pharmacological and drug treatments that can really, really improve things. The key to that is screening. And so I always tell people, you'll be screened at your six-week visit, but that's not enough. You should be thinking about screening for depression, paying attention to this possibility before that, whether it's having your partner pay attention or telling someone else, you know, pay attention to how I'm doing, because we do have treatments, but we need people to be able to access them.
Dr. Bolden, walk us through the screening process for postpartum depression or anxiety.
There are specific surveys that are given both during pregnancy and postpartum to see if someone is at high risk for either postpartum depression or anxiety. These are validated surveys, and we know that they are very good at picking up these disorders. It's something that is very easy to fill out. They can be translated into multiple languages, so it's a pretty simple way to assess someone's mood or state of being at the time.
Dr. Bolden, after birth, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends bringing the infant to at least 3 pediatrician visits in the first 2 months. But the person who gave birth usually just gets 1 postpartum appointment 6 weeks into recovery. Is that enough?
No, I think that's the simple answer. It's certainly not enough. There's a lot of work being done and a lot of strides being made now to pay much more attention to the health of the delivering patient, right? So 6 weeks, that's a great checkpoint. But now also we recommend another checkpoint about 1 to 2 weeks after. And it doesn't absolutely have to be an in-person visit, even just a telehealth visit, a phone call to check to see how mom is doing, maybe check on the blood pressure, check on the mood. And then also in other or in different states, different areas of the country, there's been a real focus on mom's health for the entire year after delivery, not just in that 6 week period. So hopefully this can provide some continuity from the pregnant state to postpartum state to state of being after all of this is over with.
I think we should acknowledge that there's a loneliness and isolation that can come with pregnancy complications. Emily, how are you seeing the conversations change around complications and how often they happen?
One of the primary goals we have with this book is to make it more possible to talk about these complications and even to be here on NPR and have people call in and say, you know, I had a serious blood clot in my vagina. I think that is so important to say so people feel that it is okay to talk about this. It is okay to say what happened and that that's something other people could expect to hear. And it helps us all feel less alone. I have been amazed at the degree to which people are willing to share their own stories to try to help other people who might be in that situation in the future.
Dr. Bolden, there are so many questions we could get to, but generally speaking, if someone's listening right now who may be pregnant or someone who's had a complicated pregnancy in the past and is maybe considering another pregnancy, what's your advice for them about how to approach that decision-making process and how to establish a relationship with their physician that can guide them through that experience in a way that hopefully is less stressful?
Right, right. I think it's really important from a provider standpoint to know that we want to partner with patients. We really want to be able to walk with a patient through whatever the journey is. So my advice would be to perhaps seek a pre-pregnancy or preconception consultation with your OBGYN or with a maternal fetal medicine specialist. This way, we can gather all the information that is needed and hopefully help someone more with their decision-making about pursuing another pregnancy or not. But this also means getting all the information on their end and really not being afraid to, again, ask the hard questions to determine which is going to be the best situation and best decision for any particular patient.
Emily, your thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I think that talking to a provider in advance, talking about what happened in the past, talking about what you're hoping for in the future, and finding that right fit, someone who you feel that you can be comfortable speaking with and asking questions to and who's really going to listen to you, that is the first step to successful decision-making going down the line.
That's Brown University economist Emily Auster. She's the co-author of the Parent Data book series and newsletter. Her newest book, written with Nathan Fox, an OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist, is called The Unexpected, Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications. It's out now. We were also with Dr. Janelle Bolden. She's an OBGYN and the chief of maternal fetal medicine at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. Dr. Bolden, Emily, thank you. Today's producers were Amanda Williams and Maya Garg. Special thanks to our friends at Vermont Public. Today's conversation was broadcast from Colchester, Vermont. And this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute.
Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives, like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.